You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Well, you remember this whole IRS scandal that happened a few months ago? The IRS was supposedly targeting conservative groups for extra scrutiny. Well, how did the media handle that? I mean, when all the facts came out, some people were outraged that the IRS wasn't actually doing its job, which is they're supposed to be administering a law that the literal interpretation of suggests that nonprofit groups aren't allowed to have any kind of political activity. So some people were outraged about that. But initially, this was supposed to be the scandal coming on top of the supposed Benghazi scandal that was going to bring down the Obama White House, and lots of comparisons to President Nixon's use of the IRS against his political enemies. Watergate was thrown around. It was a real media feeding frenzy. So how did we do, and what happened when the facts actually came out? And there were a number of things that people had assumed were true, which were then proved not to be true. How did the media do? That's what we're going to talk about today with Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of the paper Scandal Potential. Professor Nyhan, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The way this whole thing happened, first of all, let's define what we mean by scandal. In the political context, what's a scandal? Does there have to actually be any evidence, or can it just be some kind of controversy that people think represents a conflict?
Well, this is the issue that I think we haven't fully worked out. People tend to think that a scandal means that there's been some revelation of misconduct, and that's the way the word tends to be used, both by journalists and by academics, and you know, for that matter, by regular people too. The problem is when you actually try to sort out which instances of which controversies and allegations become scandals, it's actually not clear how much the evidence of misconduct is what's driving what we observe. So in some cases, we see scandals when the evidence of misconduct is quite weak or fragmentary or inconclusive. And in other cases, we see pretty compelling evidence of misconduct that doesn't turn into a scandal. And so I think to understand scandal, we have to think not just about the evidence of misconduct, but the political and media context in which that controversy takes place.
Well, yeah, context is everything here, because it seems to me, and reading your paper, it seems to me that you have to have two things for a scandal to occur. And one is an opposition party that's energized, and the other is a cooperative media. Without both of those at the same time, you don't have a scandal.
That's right. That's right. What I call that process in the paper is that I think of scandal as a co-production of the opposition party and the press. Neither can do it alone. The media doesn't want to be out in front of a scandal by itself without support from the opposition party. The risk of appearing biased or like they have some sort of an agenda or axe to grind, I think, is quite high. And that's what you saw, for instance, after 9/11, when Democrats became very gun-shy about criticizing President Bush. The media was very reluctant to be out in front of negative coverage without backing from the opposition party. And likewise, when the opposition party is pushing a scandal and the media doesn't pick up on it, it usually doesn't go anywhere. And this is what we saw, for instance, during Obama's first term in office with allegations of scandal involving loans to the firm Solyndra, as well as what's called Operation Fast and Furious. These were two scandal allegations that Republicans pushed quite hard, but never really got any traction on with the media, and as a result, they didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, why was that? I wondered why the media didn't pick up on those a little more. There must have been something about those stories that didn't make them sexy enough for the news cycle, because Lord knows the 24-hour news cycle will cover just about anything, including lint.
They do have a lot of time to fill. those stories were complicated, and that they didn't lend themselves to simple visuals and narratives, which are what the 24-hour news cycle likes. The scandals that do take off often are much easier to tell the story of what happened and to show the reader or the viewer visually. But another problem is just there was a lot going on in Obama's first term. The country was trying to recover from an economic crisis. There were all sorts of foreign policy events during Obama's first term, and then a very dramatic and exciting campaign all the way from the primaries through the general election. So the media had a lot to write about, and one important difference in the environment, I think, today is that in Obama's second term, there's been much more of a kind of news drought for the political reporters. Obama's agenda isn't really going anywhere on Capitol Hill. There's been something of a stalemate between the parties, and they're in kind of a second term doldrums. And that's when you have a bored press corps looking for a story to write, you can often get a lot more traction.
So then we really need three things to have a scandal that's covered in the media. We need an energized opposition party. We need a cooperative media. And we need a slow news day.
Yeah, that's right. Or a slow news period. Yeah. And one other thing I talk about in the paper is a president who the opposition party wants to go after. Their base is looking for them to go after. So those folks are the high demanders for both scandal news from the media and scandal allegations from the opposition party. We saw that, for instance, with President Clinton, who had a very aggressive and assertive, who faced a very aggressive and assertive opposition from the Republican base from the beginning of his presidency, and that helped mobilize activists and members of Congress to pursue scandal allegations throughout his time in office, and I think played a key role in some of what eventually turned into large scandals, including ultimately the Lewinsky scandal.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this IRS story, because this very quickly became kind of a firestorm, and I use that term because firestorms tend to feed themselves. They create their own heat and they sustain themselves, and absent some sort of outside agency, change in the weather or something, they will continue to burn until they run out of fuel. And so we had this media firestorm that started almost immediately. It was like there was a confluence of events there, a second term president, so in other words, a lame duck because he can't run again. The second-term president, predictions about second-term doldrums. We had the Benghazi thing that had just barely faded out, but it was still there. And then all of a sudden, this happens. But a lot of reporters kind of rushed, didn't wait for the facts. They kind of stopped being reporters and turned into pundits, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that's one of the dangers, is that when all these things line up for a scandal, when the situation is right and there's some initially seemingly damaging allegation or development, the media jumps on it, and they jump on it not just in terms of reporting about the core elements of the controversy, but this pundit style analysis you're describing, where essentially they're writing a whole series of additional stories about the political consequences of the alleged scandal, the damage it could do to the president, his administration, his allies. They're flooding the zone with these sorts of stories in a way that can really saturate the media landscape. And that can be a problem because in a lot of cases, the facts aren't known at that initial stage. In a piece I have that's going to be going up on the website of the Columbia Journalism Review later today, I show that most of the coverage of the IRS scandal happened in those first couple of weeks after the initial disclosure, and when more exculpatory facts emerge later in the controversy, they're given much less coverage by comparison. And essentially by then, the cat is out of the bag. The scandal's already been solidified in the minds of elites and the American public to the extent they're paying attention. And it's not clear how many people actually learned what really happened.
Mm-hmm. And of course, most of us aren't going to actually go to the law books and read what the U.S. code is regarding 501c4 organizations is. It's a lot different than what most people assume, and even according to some, what the IRS actually practices. No one did that. No reporters did it until late in the game. So we had this kind of firestorm of coverage right off the bat. There was maybe a little bit of pushback on some of it, but it was covered. Then we had Daryl Issa holding hearings. And then the next big piece of this was when Congressman Issa was not going to release the transcripts of his interviews with IRS employees. And that became a story. This scandal eventually kind of ran out of steam on its own. There wasn't really something that necessarily pushed it off the front page, but it just kind of ran out of gas.
Yeah, well, and I think it might be worth taking your readers back through why this seemed to be such a big, I should say your listeners back through why this seemed to be such a big controversy at first. A tax exempt status that you're referring to in terms of the law, the IRS receives applications from organizations applying for tax-exempt status and has to make judgments about whether to approve those applications. The initial disclosure from the head of the division of the IRS that approves these, that reviews these applications, she apologized for what seemed to be initially inappropriate targeting of conservative groups, that Tea Party groups were receiving disproportionate scrutiny when they applied for tax-exempt status. Okay, and that was a very explosive allegation. It combined, it played on feelings that the Obama administration was highly politicized and targeting or unfairly treating conservatives. And as well as the general resentment or distrust of the IRS as an institution. Those were very powerful, explosive allegations. And in that first week or two, there were very big questions being asked about how pervasive this practice was and whether it was directed or linked in any way to the Obama administration. Okay, so that's the context of why it seemed to be such a big deal. But of course, at the time, no one really knew what had been happening. And as they dug deeper, they learned that in fact it wasn't just conservative groups who were receiving this sort of scrutiny. There was a whole series of keywords that were being used to target groups for additional scrutiny, which also included liberal terms like occupy or progressive, as well as other kinds of political words relating to the Palestinian rights groups, as well as even non-political groups like open source software groups. So there were a whole series of different kind of clumsy mechanisms the IRS was using to try to determine which group should receive further scrutiny. And it's not at all clear at this point that this was targeted in any way at conservatives specifically. But unfortunately, all those developments that I just mentioned happened after that initial surge of coverage. The media had already gone out with a conservative targeting story, and I think that's still the impression that many people have been left with.
Well, exactly, and polls show this. And I guess in watching all the coverage, and it was some of it was very difficult to watch because it as somebody who's worked in the media pretty much my entire life, some of it was very difficult to watch because you saw people not doing their jobs. I didn't hear anybody ask, well, isn't this what the IRS is supposed to be doing? When people make an application, they're supposed to be checking on these things because there are certain things, if you're going to be a 501c4, you're not supposed to be doing. And I didn't hear anybody ask that question. In fact, well, actually, I did at one point, and then that person was ridiculed by the other people on the panel that he was with. And when people were saying, well, let's wait for all the facts to come out because we don't know anything yet, those people were kind of shouted off the stage by other people who supposedly were journalists. And there was just there was plenty of bad behavior going around. I'm just wondering if and we're going to take a break here, and I want to see what our listeners have to say about this as well. But Professor Nyhan, when we come back, let's maybe talk about some of the behaviors that took place in the media during the first 3 or 4 weeks of this thing. And kind of see if there's a pattern here that's different from one that we may have seen before. And you've been looking at this going back quite a few years. Let's talk about whether or not anything has changed, because it does seem a little different this time around. I grew up and in the Watergate era, and so I remember what that coverage was like. And there's a line I think you can draw back to that from this, and just in terms of how the story is covered. Let's talk about that when we come back. Listeners, what do you think? How did the media do on this whole IRS kerfuffle? The scandal involving the alleged targeting of conservative groups, which turned out not to be in fact true. How do you think the media did? What could they have done differently? What kind of reporting would you like to see? Or do you think that they didn't make enough of this, that they should have made it a bigger deal, that there was more here than was reported? Either way, join the discussion at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back with more on this topic. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, this coming Monday marks the one-year anniversary of the horrific shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Monday at 2, Kathleen Dunn will speak with Pardeep Kaleka, the son of the temple's president who was killed in the attack, and Arno Michaelis, a former white supremacist who now works with the Forgiveness Project. They'll be discussing what comes after violent acts of hate and how to teach tolerance. Additionally, community members will be holding a memorial 6K run walk honoring the six victims of the tragedy this coming Saturday, and a vigil titled Uplift and Heal is planned for Monday evening from 8 to 10:30 p.m. You can find more information about these events on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Coming up later today on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert take a look at what Wisconsin's summers were like during Prohibition with their guest, Jim Drager, author of Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries. This hour, we're talking about how the media did on the IRS scandal. My guest is Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College and author of Scandal Potential. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. We'll get to calls in just a moment. But let's talk about some of the media behaviors that we saw during the early parts of this. And we've discussed some of them. I just want to make sure that we kind of sum this up before we move on. In the first few weeks, basically, there was a certain amount of bandwagon mentality, wasn't there? I mean, once a number of outlets had reported this, then everybody jumped on it. Was this a reaction to some of the way that the coverage of the original Watergate scandal went down, where it was really only the Washington Post at first before this thing finally broke open and everybody picked it up? In this case, we had everybody picked it up right away. Is that in part the news media today feels like they blew it back in the early 70s and they're trying to make up for it, or what?
Well, there's been a real shift in mentality from the presumption of innocence on the part of elite members of the political class to a kind of presumption of guilt, and I think in some cases that helps fuel the sort of pack journalism behaviors you're describing, where a story breaks and everyone jumps on it immediately. They may not even re-report the story, but just simply write a story about how everyone else is saying that there's a story. And I don't think that's something that's new to now. And, you know, unfortunately, that's been a recurring feature of the last 20 or 30 years of the media landscape, but I do think in some ways it's even more focused and intense now because the 24/7 news cycle is moves so quickly and is so interconnected through things like Twitter and the internet that, you know, people are moving these stories forward on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis. And to simply sit something out and say, we're going to wait a week or two and see how the facts shake out on this, is literally unthinkable for a media organization. You just can't sit out a major story. No one wants to sit out the next Watergate, even though most of these stories won't turn out to be that. They're supposed to be covering the news of the day, and so they chase those stories just like everybody else. And the incentives they face are very strong. You know, we should be clear here that we're not this isn't just simply about these reporters as people. The incentives are very strong, both commercially and professionally, for journalists to chase these stories. It's what is, you know, of most interest, arguably, at the time that the story is happening. And it's what other journalists expect that outlet to cover. And so they tend to do it. Unfortunately, when they get it wrong, it's also very difficult, and there are very weak incentives to put a story on the front page saying we were wrong. And that story we were telling you about 2 weeks ago actually turned out to be something completely different. And so what you tend to see is a bunch of mealy-mouthed sort of half exculpatory stories buried inside of the paper where no one will pay attention.
And in the meantime, individuals have careers ruined.
Well, that's right. That's right. There's a famous quote from someone who's involved in a case like this about where do I go to get my reputation back? And I think people who are subject to these sorts of feeding frenzies, might ask that sort of question. There was an interesting story about someone who was mistakenly identified as being linked to the Boston Marathon bomber during the coverage of that case, where the media started reporting something that they had no evidentiary basis for, and this poor person's family, had their relative's name, dragged through the mud. So these things really can have very serious consequences. And I think it's important to not take them lightly. It should do serious reputational damage to a media outlet to get a story wrong. And to the extent that we give them a pass on that, we just encourage more of this sort of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have full phone banks as expected. Let's take a call from Milwaukee. Sean is on the line. Sean, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I can't complain, I guess. I just wanted to comment, not just necessarily on this whole IRS coverage deal, but just in general that most media outlets these days, none in particular, it just seems to be all of them, have this tendency to just throw out these wonderfully provocative and controversial headlines based on reliable sources and facts that basically just end up being hearsay and rumor, and they don't bother to think about the consequences. I noticed it firsthand when I was actually downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan, and some of the headlines that my family would talk to me about when I actually got to talk to them, I would sit there and go, well, wait a minute, these are not facts. These are nothing more than basically, your average water cooler talk at an office. And they don't bother to think about what it does to lives and to people. And it basically, more so these days, seems to be more about how many hits on our website can we get, how many magazines can we sell, than actual, true, down-to-earth, hard-hitting reporting anymore.
Professor?
Yeah, well, the media landscape has changed a lot. The so-called hard news organizations used to be run as something of a public trust. They weren't intended to be especially profitable. They were essentially prestige outlets or family-owned businesses. And that's all changed. And the landscape is much more competitive, which means that, they're facing challenge from a whole series of competitors they never faced before. and they have to be profitable. So they need to write headlines that people want to read and will click on and will forward to their friends. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes that can lead to overhyping of stories. Now, we should be clear here that this isn't a problem that is new, right? Journalists have been overhyping the stories they write for probably as long as there has been journalism. But, you know, we might worry that the incentives are getting worse, and I think that's a real concern.
Sean, thanks for the call. Let's go to Minneapolis next, where Al is listening. Al, good afternoon. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Professor, I was wondering, during the conversation, it seemed like there was conversation between you two in regard to the fact that the right wing was initially targeted more from the IRS, and as facts came to light, it was found out that there was also targeting of left-wing groups. Was that targeting 50-50, or was it more heavily in one side than the other? I know that I've heard a number of Tea Party groups and people that were members of Tea Party groups being interviewed and expressing their stories, but I don't know that I've ever heard anybody from a Occupy movement expressing their stories about how they were targeted. So part of me is saying, how much of this is really the media buying into somebody else's narrative of saying, oh, Jesus, had to be equal. We need to divert attention from what was really going on here.
Professor?
I don't know that we know the exact distribution, you know, whether there were more liberal groups or conservative groups. I do want to be clear here that this it does seem to be real. I mean, I'm reading here from the Associated Press, besides Tea Party lists used by screeners to pick groups for close examination also included the terms Israel, Progressive, and Occupy. And I believe, you know, several reporters have stated that the only groups who actually had their tax-exempt status denied were liberal, not conservative. None of the conservative groups. You know, if to the extent that you define harm as having your tax exempt status denied as opposed to delayed or having to answer lots of questions, I believe the only groups that were denied were actually on the Democratic side. But again, that's very rare. You know, these audits or reviews are much more like tax audits for our own taxes. Most people's taxes aren't audited. It's simply too labor intensive. It's a pretty rare event, so I think something similar applies here. But just to get, you know, just to underscore the point, I don't think we know the distribution, but that's precisely the point, right? We know the evidence at this point is not consistent with the story of there being with us having a firm conclusion about whether conservatives were targeted more than liberal groups. I think we should find that out, you know, I think a lot of people haven't even learned that anyone besides conservative groups were targeted in the first place.
Al, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Dave in Madison. Dave, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I applaud the previous caller. Now, being a Tea Party member for 2+ years and how the person who started the organization and what she went through with the government, I got names. I got plenty of names. I saw a roundtable meeting of all these Tea Party groups that have names behind them. And now you, being a journalist, you basically brought out liberal, progressive, Occupy, Palestinian. Well, you know something, sir? You just gave me a generality. Can you give me names? Because last time I checked, it was supposedly from, and this came from Washington, D.C.'s office, 92 conservative groups and 6 liberal. And when I call Washington, D.C., just asking for the names of those 6, they don't seem to have them. But, sir, if you want, I'll be glad to give you my number, and I'll give you all the names of these organizations that were founded and that did apply. Now, please give me names that you basically stated. You stated as proof that they were targeted. Now, give me the names of the group, and because I've yet to hear any names from any of these liberal groups.
To Dave's point, the way the IRS, the way this was reported, the IRS wasn't putting in the names of groups; they were putting in search terms. Were they not, Professor?
That's right. Well, they were looking for matches between these search terms and the names or contents of the applications, I believe. But I think the caller's point was that we don't have as many, we might not have as many liberal groups named in the public record as subject to this additional scrutiny as on the conservative side. And that may very well be true. Here are some examples of different names that just looking at articles I've consulted. Minnesota Break the Bonds, which was described as a tiny Palestinian rights group that received additional questions. They also say medical marijuana purveyors, organizations formed to carry out President Obama's health care law, and open source software developers. And we should be clear here also that this was a small part of all the applications for tax exempt status. So the New York Times says that 22,000 applications were not approved in the initial review in 2012. Of those, 296 were flagged as potentially being from political groups. Okay, so this is a very small portion of this large universe of various sorts of potentially tax exempt groups. This is a big complex story, and one that I think the in some ways the policy issue here that our host has been reminding us of might be the more difficult and important one going forward, which is what's a fair way to implement a fairly ambiguous law that's difficult for the IRS to comply with, because clearly this issue isn't going away. And anyone is going to be very sensitive to these sorts of questions in the future.
Well, there was I watched a snippet of an exchange between, and I forget which member of Congress this was, and an IRS official. And the member of Congress was actually reading from the original statute that created the 501c4 status, which was passed, I think, back in the 1950s. And the statute itself says that these organizations are supposed to have an exclusively civic or charitable purpose. And the way the IRS wrote the rule that they use to enforce this law, I think they changed exclusively to is either primarily or mainly or something like that. And so the ambiguity there would seem to be at the IRS, not in the law. Those reporters that went back and looked at the law as it was created and the context in which it was created came away with the conclusion that that groups applying for this status aren't supposed to be involved in politics pretty much at all. And I'm just wondering why that never really became part of the narrative.
Well, you know, laws are tricky. I'm not a lawyer, but the difference between the words of a statute and the way in which it's interpreted can often be pretty substantial. And in practice, many groups were applying and receiving tax exempt status that were at least partially political. So that was the de facto status quo going into this. As long as the political nature of the groups wasn't too over the top, they were tending to get through. But again, it's a very difficult issue, and one that if the standards were more clear, maybe there would be less potential mm-hmm. controversy here.
All right. Let's see. Dave, thanks for the call. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we have more callers that want to join us. A line will be opening up soon for you at 800-486-8655. How did the media do on this? We'll continue that discussion this hour. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up in the next hour, a team of researchers collecting water samples from the Great Lakes discovered large quantities of round plastic pellets, also called microplastics. I'll be joined by members of the team to talk about what this means to the health of the largest surface freshwater system on Earth, coming up after 2 o'clock this afternoon. This hour, we're assessing how the media did in the IRS scandal earlier this summer. My guest is Brendan Nye, an assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College, author of a paper titled Scandal Potential. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join the program. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or post to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Let's go to Colgate next and hear from Melvin. Melvin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What I wanted to ask the professor was two questions. I'm a loyal Democrat for years and years, but talking to my Republican friends, he claims that public radio, because you get your money from the government, and like all the college professors, the same way, are awful biased. They're Democrats instead of they got their ecological instead of on the Republican side. What's his opinion of that?
Of whether public radio is or academia?
Well, both of them, because you get your money from your wages and everything from the government, that you are more tended to be more to the Democrat side because of that, where the Republicans tried to cut your wages and tried to make sure you got your funding and all that. Is that what's his opinion on that?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first, I'll leave it to our host to discuss Wisconsin Public Radio's arrangements. But in general, the portion of the public radio budget that's provided by the federal government is actually quite small. It's public radio in name, but less in funding than most people would think. And I actually work at a private college that is not funded by the government. I don't think that's especially relevant here.
Mm-hmm. Melvin, thanks for the call, though. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What did we learn, if anything, from this IRS scandal that might be, we hope, applied when future stories like this break? Or can we just expect to see more of the same?
Well, my instinct is we're going to see more of the same. The media has a very short memory, and tends to get suckered by the same sorts of stories time after time. To give you just one example, there's a woman named Betsy McCoy who promoted one of the most misleading claims about President Clinton's health care plan back in 1993 and 1994, who came back to prominence when President Obama was proposing his healthcare plan to promote yet another misleading claim about a Democratic president's healthcare plan, and lots of people fell for it again. So I think we're quite vulnerable to these sorts of stories under the right conditions. I should say though that there's an element of this that you could argue is healthy, and that is that, especially in America, we're instinctively suspicious of power, and particularly executive power, and that going back to the founding of this country, and that suspicion is going to lead to scandals that don't have much basis in fact in some cases, but it's also going to keep our leaders on their toes. Now, the problem is when it goes so far as to be pathological, and I think that's what we have to worry about in cases like the IRS scandal. But people are right to be nervous about how power is being exercised by the government, and they are right to question it. I want to make sure we're clear about that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Dave in Wanakee. I think I can't. My bifocals aren't working right today. Dave, good afternoon.
Right. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Dave. Go ahead.
The problem is that news media has been co-opted by the politicians that they're supposed to be investigating. Instead of Seymour Hersh, we got Judy Miller. Instead of Edward R. Murrow, we get David Gregory. Why isn't anyone as prepared as Rachel Maddow Why doesn't the news media have follow-up questions? I watched the newsroom last night, and it was about how the reporters were on the bus covering the Romney campaign. Of course, it's fictional, but it's also, you know, a lot of truth in it. How the reporter who was asking the incisive questions got put off the bus. And I think that most of the reporters in America are on that bus.
Professor?
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of things. The caller is quite right that access matters in political coverage. So if your job is to follow a candidate around and you depend on that candidate for access so that you can get interviews and make news for your employer, you know, they have a lot of leverage over you. And there is some reluctance to be too aggressive because you might have having your access be curtailed. And we've seen this in both the Bush and Obama administrations with them selectively choosing whom to give interviews to based in part on how they perceive that outlet's coverage to be going. So, you know, the access issue is a real one, but, you know, I wouldn't agree with the caller that the kind of, you know, that there's a simple answer to this, that simply asking tough questions would change something. There's plenty of people who will ask tough questions, and there are plenty of flacks and politicians who will dodge, ignore, or belittle those questions. And it often doesn't amount to all that much. You know, journalists in and of themselves don't have that much power. And in a lot of cases, they're covering the wrong things. They're busy asking politicians questions, and the politicians are spinning back at them when the reporters could be out actually investigating or reporting something more interesting or important.
Well, I mean, what you get is a lot of he said reporting and trading accusations back and forth rather than covering actual facts. I think that's kind of what you're talking about here.
Yeah, that's right. The covering of the back and forth is a very easy story to cover. What did Obama say? What did John Boehner say? You know, back and forth we go. But excuse me, that's not a very interesting story ultimately.
It's press conference journalism. You're trading talking points, and a lot of people are getting a little irritated with that. Let's go to Martin in Land O'Lakes next and see what's on Martin's mind today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi. You know, I'm 80 years old. I've been around long enough to see a lot of things change, but in watching the press, I remember when we used to have a thing called yellow journalism or sensationalism in journalism, and one group of newspapers was that type, and then there was the other type that seemed to want to be responsible and neutral and objective. But I think it's all come toward the other way now, and I think sensationalism has crept into all the press, and that's what it's about. They'll take a fragment of a fact, and they'll blow it up immediately into something that might get them ahead of their competitor, as you said before. I think everything everybody said on this program is essentially true. The only point I can add to this is I think what's required is, and this may already be happening, that the reading public or the listening public or the viewing public just has to become more skeptical and of the press and everything they read and hear. And it's a shame, but I believe that's what's necessary. We all have to just become more skeptical. I am. So that's my point.
Thanks, Martin. Professor?
Thanks. Well, that's, you know, the caller brings up an important point, you know, that there was a much more sort of partisan and sensationalistic press before the kind of objective model that we tend to refer to as the ideal of journalism. And in a lot of ways, what we're seeing is a return towards that kind of a media environment, more chaotic, more partisan, more viewpoints being expressed. That's much more what the 19th century political media environment looked like, interestingly enough, and not something that people know that much about. So I do think, to the caller's point, that people are becoming more skeptical of the media. You can see this in polling when you ask people how much they trust the media. They're very distrustful of the media today, much more so than, say, in the pre-Watergate era. So that has happened. But I would just make two points about that. The first is that people may be choosing selectively which parts of the output of the media that they believe, often consistent with their political views, right? So we may say we're distrustful of the media, but when the media is confirming our biases, say, for or against President Obama, for or against Mitt Romney, or whoever the case may be, then, you know, we may become less skeptical. We may jump on the scandal that lines up with our pre-existing point of view. So I would encourage people to be cautious about that sort of instinct, which we all have. The second point is just to say that, you know, we can't depend on people being more skeptical, because it's ultimately unfair to expect regular people to arbitrate these sorts of issues. This is why we have journalists. This is what reporting is for. Regular people can't sort this stuff out, and we shouldn't expect them to. And we depend on the media to help us have that shared set of facts that enable a high-quality political debate. And the risk we run is that if everyone becomes too skeptical, that we don't have that common set of facts that are agreed upon to have a debate in the first place. And that's certainly something to worry about.
Here's an email from Jan in Appleton. Does anyone really think that if liberal groups were targeted in exactly the same way as conservative groups by the IRS, that the Obama TV network, MSNBC, would not have had those people on telling us all about their stories?
Well, it's an interesting question. Maybe they have. I haven't watched enough MSNBC to tell you, but maybe your correspondent has. It's an interesting question. So, I will follow up on the people I know who reported on this story after this interview and see what's out there. But again, I would say that there are examples in the published record, and you know, people should should look a little more deeply into the published article.
Let's go to Kate in Milwaukee next. Kate, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I worked for the IRS for 27 years, and my job was a senior tax specialist, primarily, is what I did for most of my career. And although I didn't work in the tax-exempt organization, I was familiar with the requirements of tax-exempt status, since a lot of the questions that I got regarded the application process and how to obtain the tax-exempt status. I'm no expert when it comes to political groups, but I know quite a bit about charitable organizations. And I find it interesting that people can get outraged about the top 1% not paying their fair share of taxes, and yet they're also outraged about tax-exempt organizations applying for tax-exempt status and the scrutiny that the IRS requires in order to grant that status. I'm not saying that there wasn't something amiss there. I don't know. I've been retired since 2005, so I had no inside information about that at all. But I can tell you that in order to grant tax-exempt status, there should be a fair amount of scrutiny, because the organizations will not pay any taxes on anything that is in accordance with their mission as an organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kate, thanks for clearing that up for us. Professor, we really didn't get a lot of that kind of information in the reporting on this thing, did we?
No, although, yeah, it's an interesting point. You can think of what the policy people call all these various ways of not taxing income or tax expenditures, right? So that when we don't tax something, we're implicitly leaving money on the table, and that applies here as well.
Mm-hmm. So it takes two to tango on these scandals. Actually, three things. A number of things have to all come together for them to take place. In the absence of an election year, we'll probably get more of them then, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's my expectation. Now, there's a interesting cycle to these things, though, that after a scandal, there tends to be a period of, remorse and regret as people, remember the excesses of the last time around, and then a new one comes through the pike. So
sort of like
I expect there might be some interval here, but then we may be heading into more scandals in the future.
Sort of like a hangover then. All right. Well, Professor, thanks for an interesting hour.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. Brendan Nyhan is Assistant Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning. And Rhonda Fanning also handled on-air production duties for me this hour. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.